huge garage doors groaning up and down, the forklifts whizzing in and out with pallets stacked with crates of delicious fizzy drinks. I listened to the radio anecdotes about Marilyn and watched the activity across the street and down the block, where someone had opened a hydrant and children squealed in and out of the rushing water. No matter how hot it got, Mommy wouldn't allow us to cool off in the hydrant with the neighborhood kids, whom she considered a bad influence. A truck pulled up. The driver went into the building across the street, came out, sat in his truck, and waited for it to be loaded. He waved at me, and when I looked, he dove his hand into his crotch and pulled out what looked like a pale salami. I couldn't take my eyes off it as his hand pumped rhythmically to the loud rock and roll on his radio. He was at it a long time, and I lost interest, closed the Venetian blind, and joined my sisters and brothers in front of the television set. But after a while, I was curious, so I went back and lifted one of the blinds. He still sat there, but his hand now toyed around his crotch as if he'd lost something. He saw me and began rubbing again, a grimace on his face. I'd changed enough diapers to know what happened if a boy was touched a certain way, but this man, touching himself and only coming to life if I watched, added a new dimension to my scanty knowledge of sex. The fact that his penis had grown when I was looking meant something. I hadn't done any of the things women did to get men interested. I'd been minding my own business at home, hadn't dressed up, had not acted provocatively, had not flirted, had not, I was sure, smiled when he waved for me to look. It was alarming, and at once I realized why Mommy always told me to be más disimulada when I stared at people, which meant that I should pretend I wasn't interested. Men only want one thing, I'd been told. A female's gaze was enough to send them groping for their huevos. That was why Marilyn Monroe always looked at the camera and smiled. Men only want one thing, and until then, I thought it was up to me to give it up. But that's not the way it was. A little girl leaning out a window, watching the world, fulfilled the promises Marilyn Monroe made with her eyes. I, who had promised nothing, who knew even less, whose body was as confusing as the rock and roll lyrics accompanying the trucker's hand pumping up and down to words, yelled, not sung. I left the window and looked for Mommy in the kitchen. She was in her at-home clothes, her hair not curled, her eyebrows not drawn in. "What's the matter?" she asked. "Why do you look so scared?" "Nothing," I said. It had all been my fault. Somehow, my just being at the window had made it happen. I went back, opened the blinds all the way, and watched openly. He was having a great time, while I vacillated between fear and curiosity, between embarrassment and the knowledge that, like it or not, I was having my first sexual experience. I smiled at him then, a wide, seductive Marilyn Monroe smile that took him by surprise. His eyes veiled suspiciously, and he leaned over to see if anyone else was hanging out from the other windows in the building. But it was just the two of us, me smiling brazenly, while inside I quaked in terror, and him flustered beyond comprehension. I wondered what I'd done, why he stuffed his now limp penis back into his pants, zipped himself up, leaned his left elbow on his window, and parked his chin on his hand, his eyes focused on the warehouse full of soft drinks, the bald circle on the back of his head as vulnerable as a baby's soft spot. Whatever he'd wanted from me, he didn't want anymore, and I was certain it was because I'd been too willing to give it to him. You don't want to know. Dime con quién andas, y te diré quién eres. Tell me who you walk with, and I'll tell you who you are. At about the same time that Mommy started looking pregnant, Francisco was rushed to the emergency room with a stomachache. We thought he had appendicitis, but after many tests and operations, Mommy told Tata that Francisco had cancer. We moved, for the fourth time in 12 months, to a bigger apartment in the building next door, so that Tata could live with us again. Every day, Mami went from work straight to the hospital. She stayed with Francisco until visiting hours were over, then came home, exhausted, hungry, her eyes red. She was very thin, but her belly grew high and round, and everyone knew she was having a boy. Francisco was in and out of the hospital. When he was home, Tata was nice to him, prepared him special broths, cooked him creamy rice with milk, but when she drank, she was still nasty. We steered clear of the bedroom Francisco shared with Mami, kept the television low, and did our homework and fighting in the kitchen, where he couldn't hear us as well. Every once in a while, he came out of the room dressed in his pajamas, a cotton robe wrapped around his slight body, his hands large and bony, holding the front of the robe as if he didn't trust the knot he had tied at his waist. Even with all those clothes on, he looked like a skeleton. His elbows were pointy, and the skin on his face, hands, and feet was translucent. Bones stuck out of his back like truncated wings. His black hair, over which he couldn't trouble as much anymore, grew long and lanky, so that it often covered his eyes, making him look younger. Mami and Francisco's baby was born in March. Francisco was in the hospital, but he came home the same day that Mami did. For days he lay in bed with Frankie on his chest, singing Jíbaro songs in a soft voice. Francisco's family didn't want him living with us. Every time he went in for another operation, they argued with Mami that he should be with them. It was embarrassing to hear his family bickering right over his bed, as if he couldn't hear them. One time, Mami and I went to see him at Kings County Hospital. He was in a huge ward with waxed floors, beds lined up against the walls, each with a small night table to its right and a pale yellow curtain to separate it from the other beds. There was a green metal chair next to his bed. Mami sent me out to get water in a basin. She then bathed and powdered Francisco, changed his johnny, shaved him, and brushed his hair. His eyes had grown larger and settled deep into his skull. His pale skin had turned gray and smooth. He looked as serene as the dead baby whose eyes I had closed in El Mangle. "I saw an angel last night," he told Mami. "Don't talk such nonsense," Mami said, but she gave me a fearful look. "It was dressed in white and floated inside a ball of light. It was a nurse, probably." When he came home, Mami cried when she told Tata about Francisco's vision. A few days later, he was released from the hospital to his parents' house. The next day, he was dead. Tata said they fed him peanuts, which killed him. Mami cried for days. Tata took care of her, cooked special treats, and took Frankie to bed with her so that Mami could rest. Mami was in mourning for over a year, and for that whole time, she kept white novena candles lit on her dresser, their flame throwing ghostly shapes on the ceiling where we all could see them. I had corresponded with Papi for the first few weeks after our arrival in Brooklyn. I described our apartments, La Marqueta, the Jewish people, the Italian girls, and the books I was reading. He wrote back with remembrances from Abuela and newspaper clippings. But when my sisters and brother came, they brought stories with them that he hadn't included in his letters. Papi, Delsa said, had married shortly after Mami left with me, Edna, and Raymond. He had scattered Delsa, Norma, Hector, and Alicia among relatives, hadn't visited them regularly, and hadn't seemed to care what happened to them. He had, in fact, seemed relieved to be rid of them, so that he could start his new life, just as we were starting ours. I asked Mami about this. She said that, yes, Papi had another wife, and there was no chance we would ever live with him again. I wrote him a letter asking why he hadn't told me, and I told him that from now on he was as good as dead to me. He wrote to Mami accusing her of turning his children against him. Mami yelled at me for lying to Papi about what she said about him. It was all mixed up. Mommy blamed me. Papi blamed Mommy. I blamed Papi. But none of us said we were sorry. Still, Mommy insisted that we keep in touch with him. You must never forget your father, she reminded us at Christmas, Father's Day, and his birthday. You're his flesh and blood, and even if he has another family now, he still loves you. We didn't believe her. Grudgingly, we sent him cards on special days, copied out our best compositions, stayed in touch, knowing it was all show. Because in Brooklyn, after Francisco's death, Mommy became, even more than before, both mother and father to us. We could count on her in a way we had never been able to count on Papi, Tata, or Francisco, who had made everyone happy for such a short time before dying and becoming a ghost that haunted us all for the rest of our lives. Mornings, Mommy left the house while it was still dark for the subway ride into Manhattan. She dressed for work in clothes that she changed out of the minute she came home so that they wouldn't get stained with oil, achiote, or tomato sauce. She began as a thread cutter, even though in Puerto Rico she had been a machine operator. Here, you have to prove yourself all over again, she said. She tried hard, which impressed her supervisors, and was moved up quickly to the stitching work she loved. She bought a special pair of scissors for work. When she walked across the projects on her way home from the subway, she put them in her pocket and held them tight until she was safely inside the house. She then wiped the sweat off them and put them in a special quilted case she had made. We joked about her handbag, which we worried was an inducement for Mugger since it was big and bulging. In it, she carried our birth certificates, immunization records, and school papers. She also kept a small notebook in which she wrote the hours she worked so that El Bozo wouldn't cheat her on payday. She kept her makeup, pressed powder, eyebrow pencil, rouge, and lipstick in its own small pouch. If a mugger were to steal her purse, he wouldn't get any money because she carried that in a wallet in her skirt pocket under her coat. When she worked, Mommy was happy. She complained about sitting at a machine for hours or about the short coffee breaks or about El Bozo, but she was proud of the things she made. Often, she brought home samples of the bras and girdles she worked on and showed us how she had used a double needle machine or how she had figured out that if you stitched the cup a certain way, it would fit better. But even though she was proud of her work, she didn't want us to follow in her footsteps. I'm not working this hard so that you kids can end up working in factories all your lives. You study, get good grades, and graduate from high school so that you can have a profession, not just a job. She never asked to see our homework, but when we brought home report cards, she demanded that we read her the grades and then translate the teacher's comments so that she would know exactly how we were doing in school. When the reports were good, she beamed as if she herself had earned the good marks. That's what you have to do in this country, she'd say. Anyone willing to work hard can get ahead. We believed her and tried to please her as best we could. Since we'd come to Brooklyn, her world had become full of new possibilities, and I tried very hard to share her excitement about the good life we were to have somewhere down the road. But more and more, I suspected Mommy's optimism was a front. No one, I thought, could get beat down so many times and still come up smiling. Sometimes I lay in bed, in the unheated rooms full of beds and clothes and the rustle of sleeping bodies, terrified that what lay around the corner was no better than what we'd left behind, that being in Brooklyn was not a new life but a continuation of the old one. That everything had changed, but nothing had changed. That whatever Mommy had been looking for when she brought us to Brooklyn was not there, just as it wasn't in Puerto Rico. Tata's brother Chico didn't live with us, but he spent a lot of time in our apartment. He, Tata, and Don Julio split whatever money they made at their jobs or playing the numbers to buy cheap wine and six packs of beer. Unlike Tata and Don Julio, who only drank in the afternoon, Chico drank all the time. Once, when we were trying out new English words, one of us called him a bum. Mommy smacked whoever it was and warned us never to say that word again. Chico's pockets jingled with coins, which he handed out if we did him small favors. "Get me another beer," he'd say, and we'd scramble to the refrigerator. "Light my cigarette," and 3 or 4 matches would be struck at the same time. He paid us all. While Tata tended to get loud and angry when she drank, Chico was quiet and morose. Mommy said he was a harmless drunk, like a kid, and always made sure he ate something when he was at our house. "At least he knows how to hold his liquor," she'd tell us. I was on my way to school. Chico was coming in from his night job to sleep on our couch. "Show me, and I'll give you a quarter."
"Show you what?"
"Open your blouse," Chico said, "and let me see. I'll pay you."
"No!"
He blocked the hallway with his long arms. "I won't touch you. I just want to look." His eyes were teary.
"If you don't let me by, I'll scream."
"Come on, Neggy. I'm family." Sharp white stubble covered his chin. He smacked his lips.
"You'd better not bother me again, or I'm telling Mommy."
I pushed past him and ran down the stairs and out into the street. The next day, I was brushing my hair in front of the dresser in the bedroom of our railroad-style apartment. Chico lay on the couch, watching television with the kids, but every once in a while I noticed his eyes fixed on me. I turned my back, face burning, goosebumps rising. Tata called him to the kitchen. His bones creaked when he got up. As he passed behind me, he slipped his hand under my raised arms and pinched my left nipple. "Don't tell anyone," he mumbled into my ear. I collapsed on the bed, holding myself against the pain and humiliation, but I didn't scream. On his way back, he threw a dollar at me. It was wrinkled and dirty, its edges ragged. I stretched it out and flattened it with my palm. George Washington, I had just learned, was the father of our country. I put him inside my thick history book. The next day, on the way home from school, I ate my very first sundae with 3 kinds of ice cream, pineapples, nuts, chocolate sauce, and marshmallows. "Tomorrow," Mommy said, "you're not going to school. I need you to come with me to the welfare office."
"Ay, Mommy, can't you take Delsa?"
"No, I can't." When Mommy was laid off, we had to go on welfare. She took me with her because she needed someone to translate. 6 months after we landed in Brooklyn, I spoke enough English to explain our situation.
"My mother, she no speak English. My mother, she look for work every day and nothing. My mother, she say she don't want her children suffer. My mother, she say she want work, but she lay off. My mother, she only need help a little while."
I was always afraid that if I said something wrong, if I mispronounced a word or used the wrong tense, the social workers would say no, and we might be evicted from our apartment, or the electricity would be shut off, or we'd freeze to death because Mommy couldn't pay for heating fuel. The welfare office was in a brick building with wire covering the windows. The waiting room was always packed with people, and the person at the front desk never knew when we would be helped or where the social workers were. It was a place where you went and waited for hours, with nothing to do but sit and stare at the green walls. Once there, you couldn't even go out to get a bite to eat, because your name might be called any time, and if you were gone, you'd lose your turn and have to come back the next day. On the way there, Mommy bought the paper, and I brought along the thickest library book I could find. The first couple of hours usually went by fast, since there were forms to fill out and interesting conversations going on around us as the women told each other their stories. There were never any men, just tired-looking women, some with their children, as if bringing children there would make the social workers talk to them. Mommy dressed nicely for the welfare office and insisted that I do too. "We're not going there looking like beggars," she said.
And while we waited, she kept reminding me to sit up, to stay alert, to look as neat and dignified as the women on the other side of the partition, phones at their ears, pens poised over the forms handed to them by the receptionist with a dour expression who wouldn't smile if her life depended on it. Occasionally, there were fights. Women beat up on the clerks who refused them help, or who made them wait in line for days, or who wouldn't see them at all after they'd waited for hours. Once, Mommy punched a social worker who was rude to her. "They treat us like animals," she cried after she'd been restrained. "Don't they care that we're human beings, just like them?" Her makeup streaked, her hair disheveled. She left the welfare office with her back slumped and her eyes cast down and furtive. I was sure everyone on the bus knew that we had spent the day in the welfare office and that Mommy had just hit a social worker. That night, as she told Tata and Don Julio what had happened, Mommy made it sound like it was a joke, no big deal. I added my own exaggerated details of how many people had to restrain her without any mention of how frightened I'd been and how ashamed I'd felt when she lost control in front of everybody. Often, I would be asked to translate for other women at the welfare office, since Mommy told everyone I spoke good English. Their stories were no different from Mommy's. They needed just a little help until they could find a job again. Every once in a while, I could tell that the people I translated for were lying. "What do you think?" they'd ask. "Should I say my husband has disappeared, or that he's a sinvergüenza who refuses to help with the kids?" Women with accents that weren't Puerto Rican claimed they were so that they could reap the benefits of American citizenship. A woman I was translator for once said, "These gringos don't know the difference anyway. To them, we're all spics." I didn't know what to do. To tell the interviewer that I knew the woman was lying seemed worse than translating what the woman said as accurately as I could and letting the interviewer figure it out. But I worried that if people from other countries passed as Puerto Ricans in order to cheat the government, it reflected badly on us. I never knew if my translations helped, but once an old jibara took my hands in hers and kissed them, which made me feel like the best person in the world. "Where have you been?" Mommy screamed one day when I came home after school later than usual. "In the library," I showed her the stack of books. "You know I don't want you out after dark. The streets are dangerous. What if something were to happen?" "Nothing happened." "Don't you talk back." "I'm not talking." My sisters and brothers scurried away. Tata, Don Julio, and Chico left their domino game in the kitchen to see what was going on. "Monin, leave her alone," Tata said, her hand on Mommy's shoulder. "Don't you tell me how to raise my children," Mommy screamed, backing away from her. My knees shook. What if Mommy knew that I hitched my skirt up so I wouldn't look so dumb? What if she knew that I sometimes wore eye makeup and washed it off before I came home? What if some nosy neighbor had told her that a boy had once walked me halfway home from the library? I stood by the door, arms laden with books, my winter coat still on, too terrified to move. I knew I must have done something to cause her rage, but I didn't know what it could be. I wasn't about to admit to anything before she accused me. "You think just because you can speak a little English, you can do anything you like?" "That's not true." She came at me, her hands raised, ready to strike. My books dropped to the floor, and before I knew it, I was holding onto her hands, gripping the wrists tight. I didn't know I was that strong, and Mommy was surprised, too, because she backed off, her face startled. "Hit me. Go ahead. You can kill me if that makes you feel better," I screamed, loud enough for the world to hear. I stood in front of her, shaking all over, hands at my sides, martyr-like, fully aware of the dramatic moment that might backfire, but willing to take the chance. "What?" she croaked and then came at me again. I didn't move. She stopped just short of a blow. I kept my eyes on hers. She must have seen the fear in them and the defiance. "Get out of my sight," she snarled, and Tata grabbed me and dragged me into the kitchen. Mommy and I didn't speak for days, but she never, ever hit me again. After we came to Brooklyn, all our time was spent indoors. We lived cooped up because our neighborhood was filled with gente mala, bad people. The little girl who was raped and thrown over the side of a 21-story building in the projects was only one of the gory crimes I read about in El Diario. Every day there were murders, rapes, muggings, knifings, and shootings. In Puerto Rico, the crimes had always happened somewhere else, in cities far from Macum. But in Brooklyn, bad things happened on our block. One day, Don Julio, who already looked like a boxer who had taken too many hits, came home bloodied and bruised, his eyes lost behind swollen cheeks and nose.
"Ay, Señor Dios Santo," Mommy cried. "What happened to you?"
"Some kids jumped me as I came out of the subway station." They had used bats, pipes, and chains. Once they had him on the ground, they stole his wallet, which Don Julio claimed had only $4 in it, and his Timex watch, a gift from his oldest daughter. They didn't see my gold chain with the medallion of the Holy Virgin. He pulled it out from inside his shirt and kissed it. I guess she was looking out for me, or they would have killed me. It was still early, around 7:30 p.m., when Don Julio was attacked in the same subway station where Mommy took the train every day. From that day forward, I sat pretending to read by the window, watching for Mommy to come down the street when she was supposed to. Every minute that went by and she wasn't home added fuel to the images from the newspapers of women lying in pools of blood on cracked sidewalks, their handbags torn from their arms, split open, the contents spilled over them like garbage. The men they beat up, the women they raped. I couldn't stop thinking about it as I walked to school or home from the library. Every man was a potential rapist, and every dark doorway was a potential hiding place for someone waiting to hurt me. There were gangs whose slogans and names were painted in bold letters on the sides of buildings or on sidewalks. "Don't ever walk down that side of the street," a classmate told me once. "It's not our turf." What does that mean, turf? It's a part of the neighborhood that belongs to a gang. But what if I have to visit someone on that side of the street? "Believe me, you don't want to know anyone over there," she claimed. Mommy said that at night, gangs roamed the streets doing all sorts of mischief. "Like what?" I asked. "You don't want to know," she warned. When the days became shorter and night came earlier, we were only allowed out to go to school. We couldn't even go to the bodega across the street. When the weather was warm and people sat out on their stoops, Mommy insisted we stay inside, unless she could come out to watch us. Not even Tata was trusted with keeping an eye on us, and least of all me, since I'd already proved an unreliable babysitter. If I told Mommy exactly where I was going, who I was going to see, how long I would be there, and when I'd be back, she'd sometimes let me go off alone on a Saturday afternoon. "Don't walk on any of the side streets," she'd warn. "Keep to the avenues. Don't talk to anyone. Don't accept any rides. If there are too many people milling around a sidewalk, cross the street and walk on the other side." In Puerto Rico, when Mommy had laid out the same general rules, I'd found ways out of, if not completely ignoring them, at least bending them to suit my curiosity. Her caution then seemed to have more to do with keeping us from hurting ourselves. Now, it was directed at preventing other people from hurting us. I couldn't imagine why neighbors would harm me or my sisters and brothers. But I also couldn't imagine how they could help us if we needed them. We lived separated by thick doors with several bolts, windows with iron grates, peepholes. No one dropped in unannounced to chat. An unexpected knock would set our hearts thumping, and we'd look at one another with questions in our eyes before peeping through the pinhole on the door or opening it a crack with the chain secured across the narrow gap. "I can't depend on anyone," Mommy often told us, and we knew that to be true. El Bozo could lay her off any minute. The welfare workers never believed a strong-looking woman like Mommy couldn't find work. Tata was sometimes dependable, but just as often she was incoherent or laid up with aches and pains. Our neighbors were strangers, or worse, gente mala. There was an extended family, mommy's aunts, uncles, and cousins, who dropped in and out of our lives with warm clothes, advice, and warnings. But mommy was too proud to ask them for more than what they volunteered. And we were all developing the same stubborn pride, behind which our frightened selves hid, pretending everything was all right. A shot at it. Te conozco, bacalao, aunque vengas disfrazao. I recognize you, salted codfish, even if you're in disguise. While Francisco was still alive, we had moved to Ellery Street. That meant I had to change schools, so Mommy walked me to PS 33, where I would attend ninth grade. The first week I was there, I was given a series of tests that showed that, even though I couldn't speak English very well, I read and wrote it at the 10th grade level. So they put me in 9-3 with the smart kids. One morning, Mr. Barone, a guidance counselor, called me to his office. He was short, with a big head and large hazel eyes under shapely eyebrows. His nose was long and round at the tip. He dressed in browns and yellows, and often perched his tortoiseshell glasses on his forehead, as if he had another set of eyes up there. So, he pushed his glasses up, what do you want to be when you grow up? I don't know. He shuffled through some papers. Let's see here. You're 14, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And you've never thought about what you want to be?
When I was very young, I wanted to be a jíbaro. When I was older, I wanted to be a cartographer, then a topographer. But since we'd come to Brooklyn, I'd not thought about the future much.
No, sir. He pulled his glasses down to where they belonged and shuffled through the papers again. Do you have any hobbies?
I didn't know what he meant.
Hobbies, hobbies, he flailed his hands as if he were juggling. Things you like to do after school.
Ah, yes. I tried to imagine what I did at home that might qualify as a hobby.
I like to read.
He seemed disappointed.
Yes, we know that about you. He pulled out a paper and stared at it. One of the tests we gave you was an aptitude test. It tells us what kinds of things you might be good at. The tests show that you would be good at helping people. Do you like to help people?
I was afraid to contradict the tests.
Yes, sir. There's a high school we can send you where you can study biology and chemistry, which will prepare you for a career in nursing.
I screwed up my face. He consulted the papers again.
You would also do well in communications, teaching maybe.
I remembered Miss Brown standing in front of a classroom full of rowdy teenagers, some of them taller than she was.
I don't like to teach.
Mr. Barone pushed his glasses up again and leaned over the stack of papers on his desk.
Why don't you think about it and get back to me, he said, closing the folder with my name across the top.
He put his hand flat on it, as if squeezing something out.
You're a smart girl, Esmeralda. Let's try to get you into an academic school so that you have a shot at college.
On the way home, I walked with another new ninth grader, Yolanda. She had been in New York for 3 years, but knew as little English as I did. We spoke in Spanglish, a combination of English and Spanish in which we hopped from one language to the other, depending on which word came first.
¿Te preguntó el Mr. Barón, you know, lo que querías hacer when you grow up? I asked.
Sí, pero I didn't know. ¿Y tú?
Yo tampoco. He said que I like to help people, pero, you know, a mí no me gusta mucho la gente.
When she heard me say I didn't like people much, Yolanda looked at me from the corner of her eye, waiting to become the exception. By the time I said it, she had dashed up the stairs of her building. She didn't wave as she ducked in, and the next day she wasn't friendly. I walked around the rest of the day in embarrassed isolation, knowing that somehow I had given myself away to the only friend I'd made at junior high school, 33. I had to either take back my words or live with the consequences of stating what was becoming the truth. I'd never said that to anyone, not even to myself. It was an added weight, but I wasn't about to trade it for companionship. A few days later, Mr. Barone called me back to his office.
Well?
Tiny green flecks burned around the black pupils of his hazel eyes. The night before, Mommy had called us into the living room. On the television, 50 of America's most beautiful girls paraded in ruffled tulle dresses before a tinsel waterfall.
Aren't they lovely?
Mommy murmured, as the girls, escorted by boys in uniform, floated by the camera, twirled, and disappeared behind a screen to the strains of a waltz and an announcer's dramatic voice calling their names, ages, and states. Mommy sat mesmerized through the whole pageant. I'd like to be a model, I said to Mr. Barone. He stared at me, pulled his glasses down from his forehead, looked at the papers inside the folder with my name on it, and glared. A model. His voice was gruff, as if he were more comfortable yelling at people than talking to them. I want to be on television.
Oh, then you want to be an actress.
In a tone that said this was only a slight improvement over my first career choice. We stared at one another for a few seconds. He pushed his glasses up to his forehead again, and reached for a book on the shelf in back of him. I only know of one school that trains actresses, but we've never sent them a student from here. Performing arts, the write-up said, was an academic as opposed to a vocational public school that trained students wishing to pursue a career in theater, music, and dance. It says here that you have to audition. He stood up and held the book closer to the faint gray light coming through the narrow window high on his wall. Have you ever performed in front of an audience?
I was announcer in my school show in Puerto Rico, I said, and I recite poetry there, not here.
He closed the book and held it against his chest. His right index finger thumped a rhythm on his lower lip. Let me call them and find out exactly what you need to do. Then we can talk some more. I left his office strangely happy, confident that something good had just happened, not knowing exactly what. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. Every day I walked home from school repeating those words. The broad streets and sidewalks that had impressed me so on the first day we had arrived had become as familiar as the dirt road from Macung to the highway. Only my curiosity about the people who lived behind these walls ended where the facades of the buildings opened into dark hallways or locked doors. Nothing good, I imagined, could be happening inside if so many locks had to be breached to go in or step out. It was on these tense walks home from school that I decided I had to get out of Brooklyn. Mommy had chosen this as our home, and just like every other time we'd moved, I'd had to go along with her because I was a child who had no choice. But I wasn't willing to go along with her on this one. How can people live like this? I shrieked once, desperate to run across a field, to feel grass under my feet instead of pavement. Like what? Mommy asked, looking around our apartment, the kitchen and living room crisscrossed with sagging lines of drying diapers and bedclothes. Everyone on top of each other, no room to do anything, no air. Do you want to go back to Macung to live like savages with no electricity, no toilets? At least you could step outside every day without somebody trying to kill you. Ay, Neggy, stop exaggerating. I hate my life, I yelled. Then do something about it, she yelled back. Until Mr. Barone showed me the listing for Performing Arts High School, I had not known what to do. The auditions are in less than a month. You have to learn a monologue, which you will perform in front of a panel. If you do well and your grades are good, you might get into the school. Mr. Barone took charge of preparing me for my audition to Performing Arts. He selected a speech from The Silver Cord, a play by Sidney Howard, first performed in 1926, but whose action took place in a New York drawing room circa 1905. Mr. Gary, the English teacher, he said, will coach you, and Mrs. Johnson will talk to you about what to wear and things like that. I was to play Christina, a young married woman confronting her mother-in-law. I learned the monologue phonetically from Mr. Gary. It opened with, "You belong to a type that's very common in this country, Mrs. Phelps, a type of self-centered, self-pitying, sun-devouring tigress with unmentionable proclivities suppressed on the side." "We don't have time to study the meaning of every word," Mr. Gary said. "Just make sure you pronounce every word correctly." Mrs. Johnson, who taught home economics, called me to her office. "Is that how you enter a room?" she asked the minute I came in. "Try again. Only this time, don't barge in. Step in slowly, head up, back straight, a nice smile on your face. That's it." I took a deep breath and waited. "Now sit." "No, not like that. Don't just plop down. Float down to the chair with your knees together." She demonstrated, and I copied her. "That's better. What do you do with your hands?" "No, don't hold your chin like that. It's not ladylike. Put your hands on your lap and leave them there. Don't use them so much when you talk." I sat stiff as a cutout while Mrs. Johnson and Mr. Barone asked me questions they thought the panel at Performing Arts would ask. "Where are you from?" "Puerto Rico." "No," Mrs. Johnson said. "Puerto Rico. Keep your R soft. Try again." "Do you have any hobbies?" Mr. Barone asked. Now I knew what to answer. "I enjoy dancing and the movies." "Why do you want to come to this school?" Mrs. Johnson and Mr. Barone had worked on my answer if this question should come up. "I would like to study at Performing Arts because of its academic program and so that I may be trained as an actress." "Very good, very good," Mr. Barone rubbed his hands together, twinkled his eyes at Mrs. Johnson. "I think we have a shot at this." "Remember," Mrs. Johnson said, "when you shop for your audition dress, look for something very simple in dark colors." Mommy bought me a red plaid wool jumper with a crisp white shirt, my first pair of stockings, and penny loafers. The night before, she rolled up my hair in pink curlers that cut into my scalp and made it hard to sleep. For the occasion, I was allowed to wear eye makeup and a little lipstick. "You look so grown up," Mommy said, her voice sad but happy, as I twirled in front of her and Tata. "Toda una señorita," Tata said, her eyes misty. We set out for the audition on an overcast January morning, heavy with the threat of snow. "Why couldn't you choose a school close to home?" Mommy grumbled as we got on the train to Manhattan. I worried that, even if I were accepted, she wouldn't let me go because it was so far from home, 1 hour each way by subway. But in spite of her complaints, she was proud that I was good enough to be considered for such a famous school. And she actually seemed excited that I would be leaving the neighborhood. "You'll be exposed to a different class of people," she assured me. And I felt the force of her ambition, without knowing exactly what she meant. Three women sat behind a long table in a classroom where the desks and chairs had been pushed against a wall. As I entered, I held my head up and smiled, and then I floated down to the chair in front of them, clasped my hands on my lap, and smiled some more. "Good morning," said the tall one with hair the color of sand. She was big-boned and solid, with intense blue eyes, a generous mouth, and soothing hands with short fingernails. She was dressed in shades of beige from head to toe and wore no makeup and no jewelry except for the gold chain that held her glasses just above her full bosom. Her voice was rich, modulated, each word pronounced as if she were inventing it. Next to her sat a very small woman with very high heels. Her cropped hair was poofed around her face, with bangs brushing the tips of her long false lashes. Her huge dark brown eyes were thickly lined in black all around, and her small mouth was carefully drawn in and painted cerise. Her sun-tanned face turned toward me with the innocent curiosity of a lively baby. She was dressed in black, with many gold chains around her neck, big earrings, several bracelets, and large stone rings on the fingers of both hands. The third woman was tall, small-boned, thin but shapely. Her dark hair was pulled flat against her skull into a knot in back of her head. Her face was all angles and light, with fawn-like dark brown eyes, a straight nose, full lips painted just a shade pinker than their natural color. Silky forest green cuffs peeked out from the sleeves of her burgundy suit. Diamond studs winked from perfect earlobes. I had dreamed of this moment for several weeks. More than anything, I wanted to impress the panel with my talent so that I would be accepted into performing arts and leave Brooklyn every day. And I hoped one day I would never go back. But the moment I faced these three impeccably groomed women, I forgot my English and Mrs. Johnson's lessons on how to behave like a lady. In the agony of trying to answer their barely comprehensible questions, I jabbed my hands here and there, forming words with my fingers because the words refused to leave my mouth. "Why don't you let us hear your monologue now?" the woman with the dangling glasses asked softly. I stood up abruptly, and my chair clattered into its side 2 feet from where I stood. I picked it up, wishing with all my strength that a thunderbolt would strike me dead to ashes on the spot. "It's all right," she said. "Take a breath. We know you're nervous." I closed my eyes and breathed deeply, walked to the middle of the room, and began my monologue. "You belong to a type that's very common in this country, Mrs. Phelps, a type of self-centered, red cell pitying son, the boring tigress with unmentionable proclivities on the side." In spite of Mr. Gatti's reminders that I should speak slowly and enunciate every word, even if I didn't understand it, I recited my 3-minute monologue in 1 minute flat. The small woman's long lashes seemed to have grown with amazement. The elegant woman's serene face twitched with controlled laughter. The tall one, dressed in beige, smiled sweetly. "Thank you, dear," she said. "Could you wait outside for a few moments?" I resisted the urge to curtsy. The long hallway had narrow wainscoting halfway up to the high ceiling. Single bulb lamps hung from long cords, creating yellow puddles of light on the polished brown linoleum tile. A couple of girls my age sat on straight chairs next to their mothers, waiting their turn. They looked up as I came out, and the door shut behind me. Mammy stood up from her chair at the end of the hall. She looked as scared as I felt. "What happened?" "Nothing," I mumbled, afraid that if I began telling her about it, I would break into tears in front of the other people whose eyes followed me and Mammy as we walked to the exit sign. "I have to wait here a minute." "Did they say anything?" "No, I'm just supposed to wait." We leaned against the wall. Across from us, there was a bulletin board with newspaper clippings about former students. On the ragged edge, a neat person had printed in blue ink, P.A., and the year the actor, dancer, or musician had graduated. I closed my eyes and tried to picture myself on that bulletin board with P.A. 66 across the top. The door at the end of the hall opened, and the woman in beige poked her head out. "Esmeralda?" "See, I mean here," I raised my hand. She led me into the room. There was another girl in there, whom she introduced as Bonnie, a junior at the school. "Do you know what a pantomime is?" the woman asked. I nodded. "You and Bonnie are sisters decorating a Christmas tree." Bonnie looked a lot like Juanita Marin, whom I had last seen in Macon 4 years earlier. We decided where the invisible Christmas tree would be, and we sat on the floor and pretended we were taking decorations out of boxes and hanging them on the branches. My family had never had a Christmas tree, but I remembered how once I had helped Papi wind colored lights around the eggplant bush that divided our land from Doña Ana's. We started at the bottom and wound the wire with tiny red bulbs round and around until we ran out. Then Papi plugged another cord to it, and we kept going until the branches hung heavy with light and the bush looked like it was on fire. Before long, I had forgotten where I was, and that the tree didn't exist, and Bonnie was not my sister. She pretended to hand me a very delicate ball, and just before I took it, she made like it fell to the ground and shattered. I was petrified that Mommy would come in and yell at us for breaking her favorite decoration. Just as I began to pick up the tiny fragments of non-existent crystal, a voice broke in. "Thank you." Bonnie got up, smiled, and went out. The elegant woman stretched her hand out for me to shake. "We will notify your school in a few weeks. It was very nice to meet you." I shook hands all around, then backed out of the room in a fog, silent, as if the pantomime had taken my voice and the urge to speak. On the way home, Mommy kept asking, "What had happened?" And I kept mumbling, "Nothing. Nothing happened," ashamed that, after all the hours of practice with Mrs. Johnson, Mr. Barone, and Mr. Gaddy, after the expense of new clothes and shoes, after Mommy had to take a day off from work to take me into Manhattan, after all that, I had failed the audition and would never, ever get out of Brooklyn.
Epilogue. One of These Days. El mismo jíbaro con diferente caballo. Same jíbaro, different horse. A decade after my graduation from performing arts, I visited the school. I was by then living in Boston, a scholarship student at Harvard University. The tall, elegant woman of my audition had become my mentor through my 3 years there. Since my graduation, she had married the school principal. "I remember your audition," she said, her chiseled face dreamy, her lips toying with a smile that she seemed still to have to control. I had forgotten the skinny brown girl with the curled hair, wool jumper, and lively hands, but she hadn't. She told me that the panel had had to ask me to leave so that they could laugh, because it was so funny to see a 14-year-old Puerto Rican girl jabbering out a monologue about a possessive mother-in-law at the turn of the century, the words incomprehensible because they went by so fast. "We admired," she said, "the courage it took to stand in front of us and do what you did." "So you mean I didn't get into the school because of my talent, but because I had chutzpah?" We both laughed. "Are any of your sisters and brothers in college?" "No, I'm the only one so far." "How many of you are there?" "By the time I graduated from high school, there were 11 of us." 11. She looked at me for a long time until I had to look down. "Do you ever think about how far you've come?" she asked. "No," I answered. "I never stop to think about it. It might jinx the momentum." "Let me tell you another story then," she said. "The first day of your first year, you were absent. We called your house. You said you couldn't come to school because you had nothing to wear. I wasn't sure if you were joking. I asked to speak to your mother, and you translated what she said. She needed you to go somewhere with her to interpret. At first, you wouldn't tell me where, but then you admitted you were going to the welfare office. You were crying, and I had to assure you that you were not the only student in the school whose family received public assistance. The next day, you were here, bright and eager. And now here you are, about to graduate from Harvard." "I'm glad you made that phone call," I said. "And I'm glad you came to see me, but right now I have to teach a class." She stood up, as graceful as I remembered. "Take care." Her warm embrace, fragrant of expensive perfume, took me by surprise. "Thank you," I said, as she went around the corner to her classroom. I walked the halls of the school, looking for the room where my life had changed. It was across from the science lab, a few doors down from the big bulletin board, where someone with neat handwriting still wrote the letters P.A., followed by the graduating year along the edges of newspaper clippings featuring famous alumni. P.A. 66, I said to no one in particular. "One of these days." This has been an audio presentation of When I Was Puerto Rican, written and performed by Esmeralda Santiago. Produced and directed by Frank Cantor. Audio engineer, Richard Martinez. recorded at the Jacob Burns Film Center, mixed at Light Body Music. Copyright 1993 by Esmeralda Santiago. Production copyright 2018 by Canto Media.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.